Devoncast
from Radio X.
Hello and welcome to this week's Devoncast, which is the podcast which covers local politics and news from across the county, as well as arts, theatre and what's going on too. My name is Josh Tate and I hope you've had a great week. There's plenty in store for you in this edition. Coming up, we hear from a Devon MP following the tragic crash of a school bus heading to Minehead Middle School from Exmoor.
I'd like to put on record my deep gratitude to the emergency services.
I also catch up with the chairman of Devon's best performing baseball team, who are just one win away from the national finals.
Down here in the southwest, we can play it as well as anybody across London, the home counties and the teams from up north.
We meet a former Torbay councillor who says the Ordnance Survey has been getting Dartmoor wrong for 140 years. To set the bleak moorland scene, here he is reading from his new book, The Real Abbot's Way.
Hawthorns have grasped a chance of life in this unnatural hollow, sheltered from the wind, but few have reached maturity and lie split and rotting. Those that still stand are festooned with lichen, which in the breeze flaps like ragged clothing.
And Andrew Levy from the brand new Heavies has been in Devon, and we talked to him about all things from music to fast cars.
Midnight at the Oasis.
That's all coming up in this week's Devoncast.
Devoncast
from Radio X.
But first, we'll go over the border to Somerset with the horrific news about a school bus crashing on its way back from a Devon Zoo trip. One child sadly died after the coach overturned near Minehead in Somerset. The vehicle with around 60 to 70 people on board was returning from a school trip when it left the A396 at Cuckham on Thursday afternoon. The bus was heading to Minehead Middle School and slid 20 feet down an embankment and landed on its roof. Emergency services from all over the two counties attended the scene. Devon and Somerset Fire and Rescue Services declared a major incident. One child died at the scene, while 21 others were taken to hospital, two by air ambulance. Fire crews and medics described extremely difficult rescue conditions. Police say many others suffered minor injuries or were unhurt and were taken to a rest centre. I caught up with Tiverton and Minehead MP, Rachel Gilmore, who was clearly distressed about the events which happened in her constituency.
I'm absolutely devastated at this news. Perhaps I should say we, because I'm speaking on behalf of my community and I know that we all feel the same. I love Minehead Middle School. I went there a few weeks ago. It's a place full of joy and happiness and enthusiasm, and to have this happen day on the way back from a school trip is just tragic. I'd like to put on record my deep gratitude to the emergency services who played such an important role and did such a magnificent job yesterday. Over 20 ambulances, 60 firemen, the air ambulance, the police, the paramedics. It just shows that we really couldn't survive without them, particularly in the more remote areas of my constituency. So thank you, thank you, thank you from the bottom of my heart.
That was the Liberal Democrat MP for Tiverton and Minehead, Rachel Gilmore, speaking there. The Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, said in a post on X, "There are no adequate words to acknowledge the death of a child. All my thoughts are with their parents, family and friends and all those affected." One of the teachers has posted on Facebook saying, "My amazing students, I couldn't be prouder of you all and how incredibly brave you've been. You looked after each other in what was a life-changing event. We'll get through this together. I feel so lucky to be your teacher." Investigations are currently ongoing into what happened, and cards, flowers and cuddly toys have been lining the street outside the school as hundreds of families went down to show their support. I'm Josh Tate, and you're listening to Devoncast. Still to come, we meet a former Torbay councillor who says the Ordnance Survey has been getting Dartmoor wrong for over a century. We also catch up with a pop band from the 80s, the brand new Heavies. But first, history could be made in baseball here in Devon. The Exeter Spitfires have secured the Wessex Division title and are now just one win away from the British Baseball Federation National Finals. After a dramatic doubleheader against the Plymouth Mariners, the Spitfires will face the Bristol Buccaneers in a playoff in August in Bristol. A win there would send them to the national stages this September, and it'll be the first time a Southwest team has gone that far in baseball in the UK. Joining me now is the chairman of the Exeter Spitfires, Matt Cousins. Matt, welcome. What do you do at the city's only baseball club?
So in terms of the chairman's role, I do quite a lot of the admin, quite a lot of the boring stuff, really, even sorting out fixtures, buying all the kit that's needed, running the adverts, doing a little bit of the social media, kind of a bit of a general dog's body role to sort of maintain the club process. Although we have got a good committee around us, so there's three or four of us who do it. But yeah, it's just kind of generally doing everything that nobody else does.
You are quite a busy man. Mm. How do you fit the time in to do the baseball? And some people know you as Matt from Apex. Yep. How do you fit all of that in?
I think it's about being able to sort of prioritise what you enjoy. I love baseball. That's not saying that I don't love working for Apex as well, but certainly that's what is keeps me enthusiastic. And I love the fact that baseball brings joy to so many people in and around the city. And, you know, we're part of a really good league. So actually, yeah, it's good to be able to do those things.
So Exeter hasn't really had a baseball team. Tell us the story of the Exeter Spitfires, how it came about.
So the Exeter Spitfires started originally in the early 2000s. There was a team in a league. They played against a couple of smaller teams in Plymouth and Newton Abbott, but it never really took off. And then, yeah, baseball sort of picked up. I think it started to be shown a bit more on UK TV, so people got into it. And yeah, the Spitfires in their current form started mid-2000s, and we've gone from strength to strength. You know, we used to be a team that you need 9 players on a pitch at any one time. We'd sort of turn up to a game with 10. Well, now we've got over 50 members, and we can play 2 games in one day, fielding 2 completely different teams. So that's good.
Your love of baseball and many people around Exeter, it's quite new, the team. Mm. You moving to new fields. Why do you think Exeter hasn't really had a team that's gotten off as much as the Spitfires have, really?
Certainly myself and the former chairman, a guy called Ollie, we got very passionate about publicising the baseball team. He's an incredible artist, and so you might have seen some of the Spitfires artwork that we do. And I think that just sort of pushed us to the forefront. And being the sort of guy that I am, I looked into a bit of the history around baseball. And actually, it turns out that Exeter's got a really important part of the heritage of world baseball. So there was a guy called Henry Chadwick who was born in Exeter in the 1800s, and he actually wrote the baseball rule book. So he moved to America with his parents. He'd played cricket for Exeter Cricket Club. And yeah, he went to be the cricket reporter for the New York Times. And he was going home from work one day and he saw a baseball game happening in New York, and he liked the look of it, but thought it needed some standardisation. So being a typical Englishman abroad, he said, yeah, I'll write down the rules. And that's what he did. And quite a lot of what he wrote down in the 1800s are still the same rules today. So he's in the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York. So you can go and you can see this English journalist who was from Exeter and who was called the father of baseball by many people, including one of the president it was now, it's gone out of my head, but at his funeral, you know, he had a president at his funeral who called him the father of baseball. So yeah,
obviously with that incredible history about Henry Chadwick, is there anything else that links Exeter to him as well?
Well, Exeter's obviously with the Henry Chadwick, but actually in 1945, the very first game of the European Baseball Championships was held at Exeter City's St James's Park. So there was a team from the Navy Stores who were based at Countess Weir called the Seabees, and they played the American Army, who flew over. They just finished campaigning in France, and about, you know, not very long after the Declaration of Peace was signed, they had a baseball game. So the army flew over. They played at St James's Park, and it was interesting because at that time baseball was still racially segregated, so black players weren't allowed to play professional baseball apart from in their own league. But because the American soldiers had all fought together, they actually had a mixed team. So it was one of the first ever times that baseball recognised that blacks and whites could play together. And it was here in Exeter at St James's Park. And two of those players who played in that game went on to also feature in the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. Wow. So what we're going to be doing is we've spoken to the football club, and Exeter City are incredibly supportive because they love all the history of St James's Park. So we're hoping that for one of the games this season, the US defence attaché from the embassy in London is going to come down and will present a US Navy baseball shirt to the Exeter City Museum to commemorate that day, because it's the 80th anniversary this year.
Wow, that would be amazing. Yeah. My big question is, who won that game? Oh.
Unfortunately, it was the visiting army. They won it 10-0. So, yeah, unfortunately, we can't claim that Exeter won that game. But, yeah, I've spoken to the Naval Museum as well, and they've sent me a copy of the shirt that they would have worn so that we can get it all made up. And we're thinking that when we start our new teams, one of them is going to be called the Exeter Seabees to honour the US Navy personnel who were based down at Countess Weir.
Amazing. The history of baseball in Exeter is just incredible. So the father of baseball,
yeah,
the man who rewrote lots of rules where it comes to the sport, being born in Exeter,
yeah,
where you have a club which is doing pretty well this season.
Mm.
What does that mean?
I think it's fascinating. I did a lot of research, and I spoke to people from the Hall of Fame. And they just couldn't believe that, you know, there was this club in Exeter, and we'll come on to it in a bit, but we're looking at having a new field starting from next year. And it's less than 2 miles away from the place where he was born. And we said this to the head curator of the Baseball Hall of Fame in New York, and he was just in awe of it. You know, that we realised that this person, who everyone who knows baseball in the States has heard of him. There's something like 160 fields named after him. There are streets named after him in the States, and nobody from Exeter knows who he is. So the fact we're trying to bring this story to the people of Exeter is really, really important. So
there's lots of fields named after Henry Chadwick in America.
Yeah.
Streets named after him. What's the name of your new field?
So we're going to go for Chadwick Field. We couldn't not do it, really. So it's down at Bromham's Farm, down by the Double Locks, where you go over the swing bridge, the old council football pitches. They've spent a lot of money after the flood works to restore it. So there's a corner there which just happens to fit a baseball diamond in really nicely in between the river and the floodplain. And so, yeah, the city council have given us a lease on that. We've been raising money to put in permanent fencing. We'd love to have some dirt down there, because obviously baseball's played on sort of a brick dust dirt. So we'd love to be able to do that. And we've got some national lottery money to spend down there. So we just want to get the keys and get going.
To get funding for Exeter's only baseball diamond, how does that feel?
It's great. It's great. And part of it is that at the moment we have to sort of hire facilities, you know, the school halls, school fields, things like that. And it's quite a lot of money, as well as all the safety equipment you need for baseball. So when we actually have our own field, it means we can train multiple nights a week. At the moment, we can only afford to do one night. It means that we can broaden our offer to everybody. So we're already looking at starting a youth team, because that's where, you know, the future players will come from. We're a fully mixed team, and actually there's a women's league that's running, and at the moment there's a Southwest team, but actually we feel that the Exeter could have a women's team that go and compete nationally. We're already basically got two squads running, so in baseball it's not leagues, it's like single A, double A and triple A as you move up and then you reach national level. So we're at single A at the moment, but we're going to have a double A and a single A team next year so that we can improve that, and actually we'd like to keep on going. And there are other options as well. So we've been contacted by the Blind Baseball Federation, and there's nobody this side of Bristol who supports blind baseball. Well, if we had our own permanent field, we could do that. We know that there's a lot of people who'd love to be able to play that sport as well. So we can help lots of people with that.
So the Exeter Spitfires really are at the forefront of change in the sport here in the Southwest. Tell us about this season, because you're one game away from a national finals.
Yes. Yeah, we are. So we move leagues. So there was the West Country Baseball League last year, and that disbanded. So we joined the Southwest Baseball League. And that is part of the National Federation. So it's nationally affiliated. And we weren't sure what we were going to do. We knew a couple of teams in there, but there were a lot of new teams. And actually, we've only got two games left, but we've already won the league. We've played 18, won 17 so far. So it's been a pretty good season. But it's not just been because, you know, we've got a core strength of some really good players. But actually, we've had over 30 different players take to the field. So we've got real strength in depth, which is why we know that we can have these two teams next year. We've had 11 of those people had never played baseball before picking it up this season. So to have those kind of people coming in is just fantastic for the future of the sport and for the future of the club.
What are the people at the team feeling?
It's great. You can tell, you know, we had a night out this weekend, and just everybody's really excited about the prospect of playing against Bristol. So we know after the weekend that the Bristol Buccaneers won the league. So we know that's who we're playing. And we're looking at now sort of making plans for the national finals in September. So, you know, we're definitely going to play in one playoff. Even if we lose against Bristol, we can still enter in because we've won our division. So actually, you know, we're already in that point where we're looking at where we're going to be going to the nationals. So, yeah, it's great.
So these national finals, what could that mean for the Exeter Spitfires?
Well, to be recognised on a national stage, I think that's really important with what we're trying to do to the club. You know, we want to have this facility where people want to come and play baseball down here in Exeter. And for us to be able to go up to the home of baseball at Farnham Park, up there, the British Baseball Federation, and just give ourselves a really good showing and show people that just down here in the Southwest we can play it as well as anybody across London, the home counties and yeah, the teams from up north.
So if you end up winning national finals, which I know is the ambitions of the club,
yeah,
could that bring more fans to the sport here in Exeter, but get more people involved here as well?
Absolutely, I'd like to think so. You know, we're doing some good work with the publicity and obviously things like this really help. You know, we used to have 9 people come, and that was all the people who were playing. Now we'll have sort of 40, 50 people coming to watch us, which is, you know, it's really good. And we just want to improve that because there's quite a big community in Exeter of American expats who love it, or people who've been on holiday and just don't realise that it's happening. So, yeah, by winning the Nationals, hopefully that would get us some more publicity, and actually people will come from all around to watch us play.
So for some people across the county who are listening to this and know baseball as a sport but don't really understand the rules or how it's played, how can you simplify what baseball is to them?
See ball, hit ball, run, basically. that's the most easiest thing to do. And once you've hit the ball, if you're running, everybody will shout at you what you need to do. And it's the same when you're fielding. You know, we're a really sort of inclusive group. So as I said, we've had 11 people this season who've never played before. So all the time we're talking to them, and everybody knows when the ball comes to them, it's like, right, you need to throw it to them, or you need to hit it and you need to run to that. So actually, you know, it can be a complicated sport when you get into it, but generally there's always somebody who's helping you through it as you go.
What's the camaraderie of the group like?
Yeah, great. As I said, I think we're well known across the Southwest of being the friendliest team, because actually we get people who aren't from Exeter who've left other teams to come and play for us because they've just seen the way that we do it is so good. We always have a good laugh on the sidelines. There's always somebody shouting or screaming, you know, as you would do, who's trying to give people encouragement. And yeah, it's a great group of people who we love spending time with.
So you've come so far over the last few years. What are the ambitions for, let's say, the next 5?
So, well, I mean, it's quite simple. We want to have a national league baseball team. There's a national league. It's mostly made up of teams from London, but actually we feel we can compete. And if we've got a facility that means people want to come and play baseball here in Exeter, we're lucky the university has got a really good group of Southeast Asian students, and Japan and South Korea, they're actually, you know, they're better in some ways than the Americans are at baseball. So at the moment, we've got a couple of Koreans who play with us, and they've been playing since they were 3 years old, and you can just see. So there's another resource we can tap into, and actually, it just, you know, the sky's the limit. Really, we could absolutely have a world class facility here in Exeter with a team to match it.
And would there be plans in the future to bring fans to the Chadwick Fields as well?
Yeah, definitely. It's got a really nice natural bowl around it. When they did the groundworks, they left a big hump of leftover rubble and everything like that. So it's actually got a nice place where you can sit and you're elevated so that you can watch it. So yeah, I'd love to be able to do that.
So when the Exeter Spitfires are up there as one of the best national teams, you can have a little stadium sort of thing.
This is
it.
It's exactly what we want to do. We want to put a clubhouse down there. You know, you could have an American themed cafe so that people come and it's what they do in the States. You know, it's a bit like cricket, where it's a whole day event, and actually we feel we should do that. People come in having barbecues, you know, spending the day, couple of beers, sat by the river watching the ball game. I think it's a great idea.
It just sounds like an incredible thing to do. So for people who may want to get involved,
yep,
or come and support the Exeter Spitfires, where can they do it and what can they do?
So best thing to do is get in touch with us through Facebook. So our Facebook page is really active and we always respond to messages on there. Other than that, we train Thursday nights at King George Fields between 6 and 7:30, and we're normally there most Sundays either playing or training from about midday. So yeah, come and watch the game.
Matt Cousins, the chairman of the Exeter Spitfires, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks, Josh. Cheers.
You learn something new every day, don't you? It's quite frankly remarkable to hear all about the history Exeter has in baseball. You wouldn't have guessed it and you wouldn't have known it. Best of luck to the Exeter Spitfires. Coming up, we catch up with one of the founding members of the brand new Heavies, and something has been going wrong with the mapping of Dartmoor for the last century.
Devoncast Radio is the speech station from Radio X.
And we educate and give people advice so they can make informed decisions about their finances.
And you could be on it.
Devoncast reports on the big decisions and the small ones that affect our wonderful county.
With your podcast broadcast to Devon and professionally produced at Radio X.
And then obviously COVID happened, and within COVID it completely changed the dynamics of children.
Find Devoncast Radio on digital radio or on the Radio X app.
I'm Josh Tate and you're listening to Devoncast. Moving to Torbay, a former councillor and mayoral candidate has set out to change the course of history. Apart from his town hall career, Nick Pannell is an avid Dartmoor walker and has spent several years studying the ancient Abbot's Way, which took monks from Buckfast to Tavistock. You'll find the Abbot's Way on your Ordnance Survey map, but in a new book, Nick explains why he and some other notable Dartmoor experts believe the OS map is wrong and has been for a very long time. Local Democracy reporter Guy Henderson has been to meet him and asked him how it all began.
2 or 3 years ago, I decided I was going to write a story, a book, about the Abbot's Way, which is this astonishing, you know, ancient trail that links Buckfast Abbey and Tavistock Abbey. Yeah. Buckfast Abbey is still wonderfully intact, rebuilt, you know, in the last century. But obviously Tavistock Abbey now in ruins. But the monks who were living in those abbeys wanted to get from one side of the moor to the other. And the easiest way to do that was to go right over the top of the moors.
Yeah.
So this route, called the Abbot's Way, has been well known, you know, for centuries. And there's a lot of mythology, a lot of tradition has built up around the route. And it's always been known for ancient medieval crosses, which were erected by the monks as waymarks to get from.
So would those have been the way in which they found their way across the moors,
yeah,
from cross to cross?
So they were positioned, and some are still in place to allow you to follow them line of sight. So you reach one, and you go, where do I go from here? And then you go, oh look, up on the hilltop there's a remote little cross, and so you go to that one. Unfortunately, over the years, a lot of them have been lost, but they're still in the heart of the moor, Guy. There are still enough of them in place to navigate by these ancient crosses.
And we're talking about the very heart of the moor. We're talking about somewhere where you can't see the ice cream van from. This is the heart of the moor. This is for argument's sake, the wild moor.
Yeah, this is the high moors, you know, yeah. And it's a barren place, and it's really difficult to navigate in those areas. You know, sudden mists and mires, you know, will often, you know, overwhelm you or ensnare you, and so you need to be able to navigate across the moors. It's a featureless place up there, so these waymarks were really useful in, mm-hmm. In providing some kind of orientation for the monks. But the route which I'm which I was determined to follow, there's no existing path. There's no little bit of gravel and, you know, nicely trimmed borders. It's wild open moor. Mm-hmm. That, as you know, from anyone who has spent time on the open moors, it's, you know, peat hags, you know, a maze of sheep tracks. It's, you know, uphill and down dale, you know.
It's quite difficult terrain, and it would have been the same for the monks in medieval times.
And in many ways, Guy, it's worse now, because the tinners that arrived in the later medieval period, you know, sort of tore up the landscape. Mm-hmm. So you're now, you know, having to dive into tin workings and gullies and then navigate your way out to get from one side or the other. So I undertook this as a 2-day exploration, because it's a 20 mile, probably 22, 23 mile walk. So I've had to put a rucksack on and prepare for a night under the stars. But when I started looking into the detail of the route, it became clear to me that the one on the OS map is wrong.
This is the Ordnance Survey map.
The Ordnance Survey map?
Yeah.
So I dug down and I began to look in all the history books. I looked at all the main authorities that have written about Dartmoor over the centuries. And a clear pattern emerged, clear evidence emerged, that the route on the Ordnance Survey is wrong. And historians have been stating this in numerous publications for many years.
So you have big names on your side. William Crossing was one of the people who also agrees with your hypothesis.
William Crossing, in an article in the Western Morning News in 1907, says the route on the map is an old jobber's path.
Okay.
And crucially, Eric Hemery in 1985 produced a real sort of totemic work, really, which nailed it for me. And he, working with a map maker a few years ago, created a map, which I have in front of me here. Mm-hmm. Which is the correct route. But I have before me the Ordnance Survey map, which I will show you, Guy. Shows the route of the Abbot's Way starting at Crossfirs.
Mm-hmm.
And many people do that. Many people start at Crossfirs. And in fact, there's little finger signs saying, this way for the Abbot's Way. So this campaign to get the route rerouted to the north will mean the national park will also have to change its signage. And in many ways, what I'm suggesting is going to be quite disruptive, because, you know, like bad journalism, you know, once something gets in print and the Ordnance Survey route is repeated in numerous publications and on numerous websites, but if you dig deep, and people like Eric Hemery's map and Worth and Starkey, all who have researched this in depth, say it's the northern route which they followed. The important thing about the northern route, Guy, is that the northern route follows the procession of crosses.
Yeah.
There are 18 medieval crosses to follow. They are magnificent things in their own light. So in the book, which I recently published, which celebrates the real Abbot's Way, this map is included. And you can see that I've got numerous crosses, all illustrated, which follows the route of the Abbot's Way.
And you can tell that it's a tough one, because your photograph is taken at Mount Misery.
Yeah. Well, every cross has its own story. Yeah. Every cross has its own character. They're a bit like old trees. I mean, they've been battened, robbed, beaten up, but they've been re-erected, particularly by some of the great Dartmoor antiquarians. But Mount Misery, I mean, it's called Mount Misery because it's in the bleakest part of the moors, and there's a farm nearby called Foxtall Farm, which they tried to sort of, you know, make a living from the rough moorland, but failed, and Mount Misery seemed to sum up the entire experience of them. But, you know, Child's Tomb is one of the features on the route, which has its own story. But it just is a fascinating and wonderful walk. And there is no evidence that the monks who followed it did it as a pilgrimage walk. For them, it was just a practical way of
functional.
Getting from one side of the moors to the other. But for people today, it is a pilgrimage walk. For people of faith like myself, you know, following a procession of ancient crosses across the moor, seeing an ancient cross on the top of a tor, of top of the moor, and going, that's where I need to get to. It's a bit like the Christian journey. You know, it's like hardship, difficulties, but we just keep our eyes fixed.
And this is the message of your book as well. Your book is about your, this is your second book on the moor, isn't it? And this is about your spiritual journey as much as anything else.
The book is a spiritual adventure, as much as it is an historical overview of what's the right route for the Abbot's Way. So I'm taking people on a spiritual journey, and I had some amazing experiences on the moors. I mean, Dartmoor has been a spiritual place since the Bronze Age. You just have to go up there and see the wonderful Bronze Age monuments, which are evidence that 3,000 years ago, 4,000 years ago, our ancestors were searching for meaning in life and following the Abbot's Way into the Dartmoor wilderness. You know, the isolation, the big skies, the struggle, you know, it can be revelationary. I'm not sure that's the word, Guy, but we can look that up in the dictionary.
So you talk about the struggle then. Getting back to the map, do you think that the Ordnance Survey route was plotted to make it easier for people to walk? This, the real Abbot's Way, as you call it, is tough, as you say. The footpath, which is signposted up there now, do you think that was done just to give people an idea what it was like without having to do the real hard yards?
So the Ordnance Survey route is no easier, and the contested part of the route is the eastern section. By the time when you get to Nun's Cross, me and the Ordnance Survey are of the same mind. Okay, but it's this eastern section which is critical, and the eastern section, whether you do the OS map or the northern, more northern route, is tough. There is no path. There was a path, maybe you know, on the more southerly route, the OS map route, many years ago. But like so much, it's disappeared under sedge and firs, and the tinners have sort of gouged the landscape as well to add to the chaos of the moors. So it's no easier, Guy. Why I'm really, you know, particularly want to champion you know, the revised route is because it's the right one. And we you know, the whole role of historians is to look at evidence and, if necessary, make corrections to the accepted, you know, way of things.
And it's important to you, as a lover of Dartmoor and as a writer of this book, it's important to you to have the right route on the maps for posterity.
Well, in the book, I talk about the Cistercians, and I love the idea that these wonderful monks who lived at Buckfast Abbey and at Tavistock Abbey 700 years ago, you know, were following that way. Some of the fords I cross would have been crossed by them. Some of the churches I visit would have been visited by them. You're following in ancient footsteps, and that has a power and a resonance that I want people to enjoy. And the crosses themselves are magnificent. A lot of them have been repaired, and they've been standing on that exposed moor for centuries. You know, you can know what it's like up there on a winter's day when there's a force 8, you know, force 10 blowing, you know, and it's, the air is full of snow and ice. And these crosses have been up there all this time. They have been, they had needed to be restored, but, you know, granite is tough and takes some breaking. And yeah. I'm looking forward to taking people up on the moors, to follow the authentic route, talking about the history, visiting the natural beauty of the route, because not all of the 20 miles, Guy, are on open moors. A lot of the route is in Dartmoor's hinterland on the borders. And I walked this in Maytime. It's a Maytime story when the hedgerows are full of flowers and the air full of birdsong. And it was a wonderful spiritual adventure, and I want others to enjoy it.
Has the Ordnance Survey passed comment on your book and your feelings about their path?
Not yet. So I'm assembling a proposition, you know, with all the evidence, a portfolio, if you like, and I shall be sending that off to them when I've completed that with the book.
Nick, this book is lovely to look at. I've got a copy of it in front of me now, illustrated with pictures of these crosses and of your journey across the moor. It's a lovely thing. Where can people get hold of it?
So it's in most local bookshops. You can get it online as well. Just wander into a bookshop and say, I would like this book, please. And I'm sure they will, you know, small local bookshops are brilliant in providing local support.
It's called The Real Abbot's Way, A Pilgrimage Across the Dartmoor Wilderness, by Nick Pannell.
Thank you, Guy.
Thank you, Nick. Thanks for your time.
Well, we're very grateful to the Ordnance Survey, who took a lot of time and trouble finding answers to Nick's questions, which we received just after we chatted to him. The OS, which is Britain's national mapping agency, says it's been mapping the Abbot's Way route the same way since 1886, but there are many potential routes across the moor that don't show up on maps. A spokesperson said the Ordnance Survey would not want to dispute Nick's 4 years of research into the precise route. He said there was no designated track or path linking the crosses, but there are many potential routes across Dartmoor that aren't shown on the mapping. You're listening to Devoncast, I'm Josh Tate. And finally, in recent years, motor racing has become bigger box office, with Netflix Drive to Survive bringing new audiences to the sport, and Brad Pitt's summer blockbuster F1 on big screens now, to mixed reviews, admittedly. I haven't seen it just yet, which is quite surprising, because I'm a massive F1 fan, but I am going to watch it, I promise. But in Devon, Limpston Manor, the country hotel run by patron chef Michael Keynes, holds a celebration of speed. Speakers come from across all sectors of the industry. There are some fabulous cars, including from Formula One, and it finishes with live music by the River X, including this year from the brand new Heavies. Radio X's Paul Nero was there to talk cars and also music.
Midnight at the Oasis.
My name's Andrew Levy, I'm from West London, and I'm here in Limestone.
Here we are at the Celebration of Speed. We've got some lovely cars here. What have you seen that's taken your fancy?
What's taken my fancy is this car, yeah, owned by Ant Anstead. Well, I don't know what it is.
It's a funny-looking thing,
very,
isn't it?
Very, very old.
Yeah.
And anything before the 30s, I'm very much interested in. I also like Michael's car, the GT3 RS. Mm-hmm. It's got the most disgusting... incredibly disgusting spoiler, which I'm loving right now. Nice big wheels. But yeah, I love British sports cars.
But you're here to work. Tell me about you and your band.
My band is called Brand New Heavies. We've been going since the early 90s. We've been lovingly invited to perform at Limston this year. Apparently they've been after us for a few years, but they've been turned down by our very, very astute management. But we're so happy to be here this year, and we're going to play some funky music. And this is the perfect setting for the Brand New Heavies. It's lovely down here.
And you said we've been going since the 90s. You haven't just played in the 90s, had a bit of a rest for 35 years, and then come back. You've been touring since.
You know what? We've written some songs that people love all over the world. We got very big in America before we even got big in Europe. So people love the songs, and we've been doing 30, 40 shows a year for the past 30 years, under the radar a little bit after the 90s. But we people love the songs, and we love playing them. Never stop, never give up.
I was talking to another musician here today who was saying it's actually quite difficult at the moment in some of the festivals they've been playing, that cost of living is going up. People still love music as much as ever. It's sometimes hard to get people out. Why should people go and see live music and dip their hands in their pockets if they can?
I think people need to realise that live music and anything that's to do with something that's of a moment and that can't be digitised or streamed is it's really worth it going to see stuff like that. Anything that's live is real. It's a real happening at that moment. Put your phones away and go and see a live band play, because it's a one and only, it's a one-off experience which you can't copy.
I've been to see a couple of bands in the last 2 weeks, both separately, both aimed at different people, but the people were on their phones, including somebody I was with, holding their phone up to record the experience. For or against?
Definitely against. You know, this morning I was actually late to soundcheck and I got told off by my management. But I had to go and I wanted to go and see my son receive an academic award at school. He got an academic award for Latin. I didn't even know he liked Latin, but he's good. And I thought, get your camera, push the video button. And I put the camera up and thought, I can't actually see my son. I can't see the nuances in his face. I can't see him, that moment where he's surprised to get an award. So I turn the camera off.
So turn the camera off, enjoy the moment, but take a photo or get a photo. You want to remember.
Yeah, you enjoy that experience with your own eyes, like we used to in the old days.
Pleasure to meet you.
Yeah, I'll tell you, the Heavies kick out the dopest jam.
That's Andrew Levy from the brand new Heavies, ending that report from Paul Nero. It looked like an incredible day out at the Festival of Speed at Limpston Manor. It's held at the 5-star East Devon Hotel every July. And that's all for Devoncast this week. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Josh Tate, and Paul Nero will be presenting next week's edition with more exciting content for you, including an exclusive conversation with the Earl of Devon, Charles Courtenay, and Catherine Courtenay, the editor of Devon Life magazine, will be there too. I'm looking forward to listening to that edition for sure. Also, don't forget to subscribe, and remember you can find us on Devoncast Radio across much of the county too. Stay safe. And we'll be back next week.
Catch the latest episode of Devoncast every Friday at radiox.co.uk or wherever you get your podcasts.